The gospel lesson for today comes from the gospel according to St. John in the 6th chapter. We will be spending the next several weeks in this chapter, but today we hear again a very familiar story. It is a story that appears in all of the gospels and will be familiar to you. We will conclude the reading this morning at verse 15, as the story of Jesus walking on the sea will not feature in the sermon. Hear then the word of the Lord. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. Now the Passover, the festival of the Jews, was near. When he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for all these people to eat?" Jesus said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. One of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they among so many people?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was a great deal of grass in the place, so they sat down on it, about 5,000 in all. Then Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over so that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up, and from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." When Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. This, too, is for us the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. One of my favorite memories of my adolescence is of singing in my church's youth choir, and not only singing in my church's youth choir, but singing in our annual summer musical. Like Highland Park, Colonial Hills United Methodist Church in San Antonio had a youth choir that sang every week for our church's 8:30 worship service. And like Highland Park's, our church's youth choir would go on a summer tour. We would present musicals of various sorts. Some would be well known, like Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I was Pharaoh that year and do a pretty mean Elvis impersonation, if I may say so. I'm not going to do it for you, so don't bother asking. We would do Godspell, Day by Day, Prepare Ye the Way of the Lord, etc. You know the songs. We would do some lesser-known programs that were commercially available on the youth choir market. But my favorite show out of, 8 years of doing them was the story of the life of Jesus that was written by our own choir director and a songwriter who was also a member of the congregation. I think that show was my favorite because that year was my breakout year. It was the year I really entered into my own. It was my breakout role as the Apostle Philip. Now, sure, my being cast as Philip involved a bit of typecasting, as Philip is the nerdy disciple who uses overly long sentences and bigger words than he needs to, whose presentations are a bit matter-of-fact and somewhat dry, but Philip has a really good heart and he always wants to do the right thing. And fortunately for me, the writers of the show thought that Philip might have a hidden humorous side, and so the role allowed me to exercise my comedic chops. Now, in the show, Jesus has been teaching all day long. It's fairly shortly after Jesus delivers the Sermon on the Mount. So the hour is growing late and the crowd is growing restless because there wasn't anything for them to eat. Looking up and seeing the crowd coming toward him, Jesus turns to me as Philip and asks, "And where are we going to buy bread for these people to eat?" Well, with that, I whipped out a Texas Instruments calculator. You probably remember the kind with the little roll of paper that would print out the sums, and I began to do my calculations. All of this ends with a jaunty little soft shoe number in which I sing that it simply cannot be done. There are too many people and too little fish, I sing. Too many people, too little fish. My calculations say something's amiss. There's too many people and too little fish. Well, despite the role launching my admittedly short-lived comedic career on the choir tour circuit, I have often wondered why Jesus picked on Philip. In all the other Gospels, and this miracle is the only one, apart from the resurrection, that does appear in all four Gospels, the disciples as a group tell Jesus that he is going to need to do something about this crowd of hungry souls. But not here, not in this Gospel, not in John. Because in John's gospel, Jesus is always in charge of things. Jesus is always on top of things. Jesus always knows what's going on. He's always in charge. So in this gospel, Jesus calls on Philip and asks him where they're going to buy bread for all these hungry people. Now, John is pretty straightforward in telling us that Jesus asked Philip the question in order to test him, which doesn't seem like a very nice thing to do. It's hardly a Christian thing to do, to put someone on the spot, to test them. To make matters worse, the question involves what Tom and Ray Maliazzi of NPR's Car Talk call obfuscations when they do the puzzler. When Ray presents each week's puzzler, he includes little bits of information that are so tantalizing, they make the story so interesting, but they really divert you from the main issue at hand. They're thrown in to throw you off the scent, to see whether you're really paying attention. Well, the obfuscations in Jesus' question are the words "we" and "by." "We" is misleading because Jesus isn't going to involve the disciples in what's about to happen, so it's really "I" and "me," not "us" and "we." And "by" is misleading because, frankly, that's not going to happen either. It's funny that Jesus asks Philip this question because Jesus knows perfectly well all along what it is that he's going to do. But if he does, why ask Philip the question about their bread purchasing options? And the answer is because, frankly, this is a setup. The test is not a general knowledge test, a quiz to know if Philip knows about local bakeries. This is rather a trial. It is a test of faith. Because you see, amidst all the obfuscations, there are clues that point Philip and us to who Jesus is and to what's really going on. The first of the clues is the signs that Jesus was doing for the sick. All through John's gospel, the signs that Jesus does, the miracles that he performs, are special demonstrations of the character and the power of God. When Jesus performs signs as he does here, the character and power of God are at work in him and through him. The second clue as to what's going on is that Jesus goes up a mountain and the crowd meets him there. In the Bible, mountains are places where people go to meet God. Mountains are where God is revealed. Mountains are places where the extraordinary happens. Mountains are places where God is revealed in wonder and glory. The third clue about what's really going on here is that all of this takes place at the time of the Passover. Passover, recall, was the time when God led the children of Israel up out of their slavery in Egypt and led them through the wilderness to their home in the Promised Land. It was during Israel's wilderness wanderings that God fed his hungry children daily with manna, bread from heaven. But before I go on, I suppose I should stop because there I go being Philip again, telling you all sorts of things you don't want to know and giving you facts in a sort of dry, matter-of-fact kind of way. My point is, the clues should tell us what's really going on in the story. Jesus' question to Philip is a test to see whether he's paying attention, whether he's connecting the dots, whether he's putting two and two together and understanding what it is that's happening before his very eyes. But Philip, just being Philip, I guess, and true to his nature, takes stock of the situation. He does a quick statistical analysis. And he concludes that from an economic standpoint, this just isn't going to happen. It's impossible. A full half year's salary simply wouldn't be enough money in order to buy bread for all of these people to have even a little to eat. But Philip's answer is to look at the world through the lens of scarcity. There isn't enough. Philip's answer is to look at the facts on the ground and let the facts speak for themselves. Philip's answer is the realist's answer, to take an accounting of the facts as they present themselves and then to plan and act accordingly. 6 months' wages wouldn't even begin to solve the problem. Now, let's be clear, Philip's answer is not without compassion. Even if we did have enough money, Philip reasons, people just wouldn't get enough to eat. Clearly, we can't go to La Madeleine for some nice artisanal bread because that would be exorbitantly expensive, and even Panera is out of the question for the same reason. Sam's Club would allow us to buy in bulk, sure, but the cost is still prohibitive, Philip thinks. Even the day-old bread at the bakery thrift store would cost more than we can afford. Philip looks at the bread glass and it's half empty. Andrew jumps into the conversation at this point. He's done some intelligence gathering, and there are reliable reports that there is out there in the crowd a little boy who appears to have brought with him his lunch, 5 loaves of barley bread and a couple of fish. But what's the point? After all, there's too many people and too little fish. Again, it's realism governed by economic reality. It's the law of scarcity at work again. There are unlimited needs, but limited resources. There simply isn't enough material to meet the need. At least Andrew had the presence of mind to share the raw data with Jesus before drawing the predictable conclusion. And Andrew at least sees the glass as half full, so we're making progress here. The funny thing is, whether we see the glass as half empty or half full, we still see the glass as limited. We're still looking at the world through the lens of scarcity. The truth is, of course, we can always refill the glass. Or more accurately, God refills the glass. God fills it to overflowing. My cup runneth over, says the psalm. I know this because there's a great deal of grass in the place where Jesus fed the 5,000. I've always thought this was a fascinating detail. Why is it there? Is it another one of the obfuscations? It doesn't really seem to add anything to the story. Another version of this story makes the comment that the grass was green, and you say, really? What other color would grass be? I mean, apart from one corner of my yard that isn't getting enough water, grass is always green. But John makes a point of saying that there is a great deal of grass in this place. If tradition is right and the story takes place where the tour guides in Israel say it takes place, then I can vouch for the fact that there is indeed a great deal of grass that grows on that hillside. That hillside was green and abundant even in the late fall when we visited. And so as best I can figure it, this is classic foreshadowing. Maybe all this green grass that the people are sitting on is itself a sign, a foreshadowing of what is about to happen. Because it's all right there, it's all around them, it's clear as day. The question is anyone paying attention? Or does our eye have to be drawn to the detail? Does anyone have eyes to see? The stuff of miracles, John seems to say, is commonplace. Sometimes it grows up right under our feet. Sometimes Jesus even invites us to sit right down in the middle of it. And then the miracle happens right before our eyes, so quickly that we almost don't notice it. The same way we tend not to notice the grass. For John says Jesus gives thanks, and then he distributes 5 loaves and 2 fish to those who are seated, about 5,000 in all. Of course, you and I want to know, how does he do it? How does he take 5 loaves and 2 fish and with them feed 5,000 people? How is it possible to feed so many people with so little food? And as I often say when the lectionary brings up the miracles, I don't know how Jesus did it. I don't know that there's a scientific explanation. God knows we've tried to explain it as a matter of the little boy sharing his lunch and so everybody else did too. I don't think that's so. Because what I know is what the text tells me. That one moment Jesus takes bread and gives thanks for it, and the next he's distributing Filet-O-Fish Happy Meals to everyone in the crowd. And I know that that is a sign that points to God's character and to God's power. Everybody there that day got as much as they wanted. Everyone was satisfied. In fact, there was so much they had 12 huge Tupperware bins full of leftovers, which is redundant. John doesn't have to say the same thing twice. Everyone got what they wanted and everyone was satisfied, but I think John is driving home the point. The abundance of assertions about just how much food was there makes clear the size of the miracle. 5,000 people ate that day, and what they ate wasn't just sufficient, enough, a little on which to get by until the next meal of the day, the drink and a snack that you get on domestic flights that are under 2 hours. Nope. Everyone there that day got as much as he or she wanted, and everyone was satisfied. That's what Jesus means when he tells us that he comes that you and I might have life and have it to the full. Jesus comes to give us rich life, abundant life, life where our truest needs are met, our deepest hungers are filled. No one who eats with Jesus feeding them goes away hungry. because Jesus himself is doing the feeding. And when he does, the character and power of God are at work in him and through him. But one question remains. It is the question that Jesus asked Philip, and it is the question that Jesus asks us as his disciples today. How are we to feed all of these people? How are we going to take care of all the people who are physically and mentally ill? How are we going to house all of the people who are homeless? It would be very tempting to say, Jesus, there are too many problems and too few resources. Our gifts wouldn't be enough even to begin to make a difference. And that is true. Whatever we have is not enough. But our not enough is never God's final answer. In 1976, when Millard and Linda Fuller began Habitat for Humanity International, there were few resources and tremendous need for affordable and decent housing for America's and the world's working poor. With a few tools and some committed volunteers, it would have been easy to say it is simply not enough. Today, however, Habitat for Humanity International has built or repaired more than 1 million homes. My friends, when placed in the hands of Jesus, our not enough, our scarcity, our limited resources become more than enough. They become an abundance. They become a blessing of overflowing grace. Amen.